Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens...
Requiring special trick-or-treatment, tonight is Halloween. Also tonight, the Toronto Blue Jays are playing in Game 6 of the World Series. Those two simultaneous events will require deft handling by parents who are also baseball fans. But our guest says he has his game plan all mapped out.
And flow state. New science has figured out what's happening when you zone out mid-conversation. And if you're grossed out by discussions of fluid flowing out of your brain, now might be an actually good time for you to zone out.
It's not oozing out, it's just moving around, but we'll get to that. Okay. Those stories and more coming up for you on the Friday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. Now I'm going to play a song for you. This is Allison Russell with Everything I Wanted.
I had a dream. I got everything I wanted. Not what you'd think. And if I'm being honest, it might have been a nightmare to anyone who might care. Thought I could fly, so I stepped off the golden. Nobody cried, nobody even noticed. I saw them standing right there. Kinda thought they might care. I had a dream. I got everything I wanted. When I wake up, I see you with me. And you said, as long as I'm here, no one can hurt you. You can learn to. If I could change the way that you see yourself, you wouldn't wonder why you're here. They don't deserve you. I tried to scream, but my head was underwater. They called me weak, like I'm not just somebody's daughter. Could have been a nightmare, but it felt like they were right there. And it feels like yesterday was a year ago. But I don't wanna let anybody know, 'cause everybody wants something from me now, and I don't wanna let them down. J'avais un délire, j'avais tout ce que je désire, mais quand je rêve, je vois toi avec moi. Et tu me dis, personne peut te blesser, quand je suis là, te protéger. Je veux pas des efforts, mais tu peux le pratiquer. Si je pouvais changer la manière comme tu te vois, n'aurais pas dû m'énerver qu'on dit il vous mérite pas. Si je savais jadis que je connais aujourd'hui, ferais-moi la même chose, tant pis. Si j'avais su que leurs mots me fait de coups, voudraient-ils parler plus doux? Si je savais jadis que je connais aujourd'hui, ferais-moi la même chose, tant pis. Si, si, s'ils avaient su que leurs mots me fait de coups, voudraient-ils parler plus doux?
And that's Everything I Wanted by Alison Russell.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Part reset, part rebound. Amid a messy breakup with the U.S., Canada looks elsewhere. And our guest says today's meeting between Prime Minister Mark Carney and Chinese President Xi Jinping suggests the start of a new chapter.
Out of reach, as the U.N. reports on mass killings and executions in the Sudanese city of El Fasher, families struggle to reach their loved ones there. A D.C. woman tells us she hasn't slept for days waiting for news of her uncle.
The lowness of His Former Highness. King Charles strips his brother of his royal titles, reducing Prince Andrew to Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. Virginia Giuffre's brother says that is a start.
All systems goo. According to science, when you zone out, it's not just all the thoughts leaving your brain. A certain amount of cerebrospinal fluid gloops out as well.
A glaring omission. We have just learned that bats in Georgia glow. And not only that, a bunch of them glow in precisely the same way. A researcher tells us this new information is illuminating in every sense.
And the flap of the bat and the crack of the bat. If you're trying to figure out how to fulfill your responsibilities as a Toronto Blue Jays fan and as the parent of a trick-or-treater, an Ontario man says it's like taking candy from a neighbor. As it happens, the Halloween edition. Radio that listens for things that go ump in the night. Tonight is the night for fans of creepiness and fans of candy and fans of baseball in Toronto and across the country. Game 6 of the World Series, a chance for the Blue Jays to win it all. But also, of course, game time for young ghosts and witches, princesses and pirates. That has left a lot of parents with a serious conflict on their hands. A helpful printout has been circulating online that Jays fans can slap on their front doors after 8 p.m. Eastern. It reads, "Please be advised, we will not be able to come to the door and treats are left out instead." And one Ontario parent has proposed a different solution, which he's promoting via an online petition. He's father of three, Aaron Blake. We reached him earlier today in Hamilton.
So, Aaron, at what point did you realize that you might be heading, along with the Jays, into a Halloween conflict?
Right before the Mariners series started. So they beat the Yankees. And when I looked at the schedule, I realized that there could be a game on Halloween. This could potentially happen. Basically, when that came to my attention, I thought it would be worthwhile to share the news with people.
Yes.
And just basically within my smaller social circles down here, like sports teams and schools and my friends, and basically just start beating the drum that, because at first people were like, why do you want to cancel Halloween for, Aaron? Why do you want, hashtag cancel Halloween? I said, no.
You're just
not
trying to raise awareness.
Halloween. Raise awareness, change Halloween for this year. It's a very special once-in-a-lifetime experience. Like, I mean, we may never see the Blue Jays have the opportunity to win the World Series at home on Halloween ever again.
Are you, I mean, once you saw that schedule, did you start sweating immediately or were there just calculations? Did you pull up a calendar, start marking things?
Yeah, calendar. I was right at it. I texted some people. I was like, hey, this is a distinct possibility. There could be a big problem. It's like, what are we going to do about trick-or-treating? I actually text messaged and emailed Premier Ford to see if he would address the matter. He did text me back yesterday, just said, everybody will be done by 8 p.m., not to worry about it, which was interesting.
Others have circulated this idea. In fact, I've heard them saying on social media, let's just all agree, you know, it's going to start at this time, but we'll end at 7:30, and then everyone will go inside. Is that your ideal scenario?
Look, I know Halloween has a lot of meaning, especially to the kids. Yes, I think that's reasonable. My preferred time would be to start sometime between 4:30 and 5, depending on your community.
People may not be home at that time.
I mean, it is kind of early. We're going to start around that time here. So after this call, I'm going to be going home, getting the kids ready. And I have a loop of kids and families that I know are baseball fans. And we'll be hitting them up. But the goal is to have everything completely wrapped up. House back in the house by 8 p.m., getting the pregame show on, and we can just count the candy, organize the candy while the game proceeds.
There's a full strategy here, and I appreciate a nice little itinerary, controversial though it may be. How did your children respond when you sat them down and said, this is what's happening?
10-year-old not in agreement. 10-year-old not happy with me. He wants to trick-or-treat later. Yeah. He thinks the Blue Jays game will still be on when he gets home, which is right.
Good argument. Yeah.
So he's in a bit of disagreement.
It needs to be dark for Halloween, though, doesn't it? Can it be spooky? Well,
it's whatever, you know. Just I think it's got to be at least
just 4:30. Devil's advocate, Aaron.
I mean 4:35. I mean 5 to 8. Let's call it 5 to 8. 5 to 8. 5:30 to 8 o'clock. 2.5 hours. You can get a lot done. You can get a lot of trick or treating done in that time.
Fair.
So he's not too happy. The twins are okay. Like they don't mind. They're like, oh, can we even do 8:08, 8:10? I said, boys, we can go right till first pitch if you want. No problem. You want to get those extra 8 minutes? I'm okay with that.
Is that the compromise, or did your 10-year-olds can be persuasive? So did they hammer out a different deal?
Well, he's going out with a different adult. Like, there's an adult friend who's not a huge baseball fan, I believe, who's going to be supervising that group. I'm going with the 8-year-old crew.
Okay.
So
all right.
I suspect they're going to be back anyways. You know, to be fair, it kind of wraps up by 9 o'clock usually anyways.
Sure.
So what are we in, second inning by then? But it's not about seeing it at the second inning. It's about being there from start to finish.
I totally get it.
And I mean, if these boys can stay up for the whole game, they're more than welcome to. Friday night, Halloween, I'd love them to stay up and hopefully see a World Series victory.
I hope so, too. You mentioned the people who were trash-talking you and saying you're trying to cancel Halloween.
Yes.
Again, you want to set the record straight.
I want to set the record straight. I never wanted to cancel Halloween. I wanted to compromise on Halloween for the Toronto Blue Jays and for Canada. I want to split that loaf of bread in half. Everybody gets a nice fair size piece. We can still do trick or treating, get a lot of candy, and be home to watch the Blue Jays from start to finish, hopefully win the World Series.
Hopefully. What happens if someone knocks or rings that doorbell at 8:08?
Well, I mean, here I am right now. Oh, I'm not going to answer the door. I mean, I probably will still go. I'll feel bad. I'll probably still go, but I'm not going to be happy about it.
And what are your boys going as this Halloween?
Oh, so my 10-year-old, you know, 6'7", 6'7". Oh,
yes.
He's going as 6, and his buddy's going as 7.
Nice.
And then the twins are going as... they just have these nice kind of masks that just kind of like, they're like, I don't know how to describe them. Mm-hmm. Shiny, colorful.
Cool.
They're matching. They were intrigued by it. So I guess you could say like they're wearing a really cool Halloween mask.
Cool.
Yeah. And then I dress up for Halloween too. I'm going out trick or treating with them, and I'm going out as
a diehard Jays fan.
In 2015, I'm not lying, I dressed up as Jose Bautista. And I had the beard and the Batista jersey, like the painted-on beard. But this year I'm going out as Thanos from Squid Game. So I've got like the purple wig, and I'm a little hair challenged. So it's nice to like be able to have some hair tonight.
Listen, I hope it's fun when you're all settled in with the candy, and that if you're emotional eating at the end of the night, that it's because of happy emotions.
Let's just get it done tonight. I believe in these Toronto Blue Jays. I believe they will win one of these next two games and be World Series champions.
Thank you very much
for
this.
You.
Have fun.
Yep, thanks. Go Jays.
We reached Aaron Blake in Hamilton, Ontario. For the first time in 8 years, the Prime Minister of Canada has officially met with the President of China. Mark Carney accepted an invitation from Xi Jinping on the sidelines of the Asia-Pacific Economic Summit. And today in South Korea, the leaders were set to discuss trade issues. Canada is, of course, looking for alternative trade partners during the trade war with the U.S. Here's a bit of what Prime Minister Carney told reporters when he emerged.
This meeting today is long overdue. We now have a turning point in the relationship that creates opportunities for Canadian families, for Canadian businesses, and Canadian workers, and also creates a path to address current issues.
Prime Minister Carney after his meeting with Xi Jinping earlier today. Guy Saint-Jacques served as the Canadian ambassador to China from 2012 to 2016 and is now a senior fellow at the China Institute at the University of Alberta. We reached him in Montreal.
Guy Saint-Jacques, no formal agreements came out of this meeting between China and Canada today. Was anything achieved?
Well, I think this meeting happened at a very opportune time. And what was important was the tone and setting the framework for future discussions. And what also was interesting is that President Xi Jinping extended an invitation to Prime Minister Carney to visit China. So this is a sign that both sides want to work seriously to try to address the challenges in the relationship. And while it was a short meeting, 30 to 40 minutes, I think that it was a necessary and important first step.
To what do we owe, do you think, this shift in tone and this openness on both sides? Why now?
Mr. Carney realized that we may have bigger problems to come down the road with the United States. We have heard President Trump saying that he doesn't want to buy Canadian cars. I think the Prime Minister has to be realistic that Donald Trump will require concessions from Canada that we cannot agree to, and therefore the free trade agreement could disappear, which means that the 85% of our exports that go to the United States tariff-free then would be subject to tariff. I think in the case of China, they are also eager to improve relationship with Canada. They know that we could extend collaboration in sectors such as renewable energy, environment, climate change, agriculture. The manufacturing sector was also mentioned, as well as international finance. And we know that the minister responsible for international trade will travel to China in the near future. I think this will be an opportunity to further discuss the tariffs that were applied by both sides.
Yeah, I want to talk about the tariffs that are at the heart of all of this and what could change on that front. But what you were saying about the United States, so the instability and the uncertainty in those relationships between U.S. and Canada and China and the U.S., I see what you're saying about concerns down the road there could be helping to fuel this warming in relationships between Canada and China. But as you well know, and many Canadians will remember, the road behind us with China not so long ago was concerning on many fronts. China imprisoning two Canadians in 2018. The two Michaels have been released, of course. Meng Wanzhou, who was, Canada, through a U.S. extradition request, had that telecom executive in custody. There are concerns about foreign interference. Prime Minister Carney called China, quote, one of the largest threats with respect to foreign interference, unquote. So there are other experts pointing out that this kind of warming in this relationship could be cause for concern, that perhaps it's a mistake.
I think the concerns are not going away, but I was somewhat reassured when I traveled to Ottawa earlier this week to attend a conference, and Minister Anand came to address us, and she said that while Canada wants to have a strategic partnership with China, the government intends to increase the efforts to counter Chinese interference. So Mark Carney is perceived as a serious and competent leader by Chinese leaders, then I think Mr. Carney will be firm on issues related to human rights, including freedom of speech and religious freedom, while telling the Chinese, if you happen to interfere in Canadian politics, there will be consequences. Those are red lines for us.
The Prime Minister can say those things, but would China adhere to those red lines?
The onus is on us because we are in charge of applying the rules in this country. And I think that it was not necessarily the case under Mr. Trudeau. I find it very difficult to explain why the registry for foreign agents was not put in place much earlier. If we are serious about defending our democracy, there should be zero tolerance for such behavior. But for that to happen, we have to send a message to members of the Canadian Chinese community that they can go to the police and that mm-hmm. the police will follow up.
On the issue of tariff struggles between Canada and China, could we see the lifting of tariffs just as a result of this initial meeting?
I would be surprised if we would see these tariffs disappear. It's true that Chinese auto manufacturing industry is heavily subsidized, and there is overproduction, so there are incentives to try to increase market shares abroad. So I think that the Prime Minister recognized that right now farmers in Western Canada are suffering, that also fishermen in the East are suffering, as well as pork producers in Quebec. Maybe we are getting close to the stage where we could invite Chinese auto manufacturers to come to Canada to build plants to serve the Canadian market, but with the caveat that after a few years, they would have to have a 40% Canadian content in their cars, and after 10 years, 100% Canadian content. This would help to create jobs in Ontario, especially as we have started to lose employment in the auto industry.
You're describing a significant shift in partnerships.
Oh, yes. Well, it would be, and we have to all at the same time acknowledge the fact that China has become a center of excellence, that they are producing high-quality products at interesting prices. To that with Japanese or Korean car producers in the 70s and 80s, but with the big difference that this time the U.S. market won't be open to those manufacturers. They would only be able to serve the Canadian market.
Guy Saint-Jacques, I'm very glad we could speak. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Guy Saint-Jacques was Canada's ambassador to China from 2012 to 2016. We reached him in Montreal. If ever there was a night to glow in the dark, it's tonight. On Halloween, there's a real utility to luminescence. It adds to the ambiance, it freaks out the people whose doors you knock on, it might even get you some extra candy. And it has the bonus side effect of making you more visible while trick-or-treating in the dark. Glowing tonight just makes sense. But some animals glow all the time, and in many cases, scientists don't fully understand why. Now, a new study on six different species of improbably glowing bats is adding to the mystery. Brianna Robertson is the lead author, and we reached her in Harrisonburg, Virginia.
Brianna, when anyone, I mean, hears the phrase glowing bats, I think a lot of images come to their minds. But can you describe what you're actually seeing?
Yes, so we're seeing a phenomenon called photoluminescence. It's a little different from what most people probably think of when they're thinking of the word luminescence. You might picture like the glowing jellyfish or the glowing plankton that are really popular. But photoluminescence is a little bit different. It's not produced by the organism itself by like metabolic processes. It requires an incident light that excites these fluorescent molecules and they produce a glow.
So you wouldn't be able to see this with the naked eye outside a lab?
Jury's still out on that, but it does require some sort of UV radiation in the surrounding environment.
And what parts of these bats' bodies are glowing?
It's actually their patagium, which is the skin that makes up their wings and also in between their legs. It's a little different from a lot of the other mammals that glow. Most of them glow in their fur, so that's cool.
It is cool, to say the least, yeah. I know that as you said, scientists have known that some animals, some bats, do glow, but there are different levels to what you've found in this research.
Yes, so we specifically looked at bats that are native to the southeastern U.S., and we also looked at bats with really specific ecologies. So we could kind of test some hypotheses about, well, are there differences related to the environments that they prefer or some other aspect of their ecology?
And six species all glow in the same way?
Yes, we didn't see any differences in the color that they glow.
Quite a varied range of species as well, right?
Yeah, we have a couple species that prefer to roost in leaves. Some of them like caves. And we also have one species that migrates to South America. So a wide range.
And the fact that they all glow in the same way, what does that tell you about why they may do this, why they have this trait?
We suspect that provides evidence that it's probably a trait that's been inherited from an ancestor of all of them. So it could be an early mammal, could be an earlier bat, and the trait's just been passed on.
And is it possible that it still serves them somehow?
It is possible. We've examined a couple hypotheses, and we've been able to rule out some functions that we thought maybe it was serving. We still don't know exactly what it does, so there is the potential that maybe it serves some function in their evolutionary history and it doesn't anymore, or maybe it still does.
We do a lot of stories about, in the field of science and this kind of research, and often when animals do something, it's to attract a mate. Is that a possibility?
It was one of the hypotheses that we tested, for sure. We didn't find any evidence of that, just because we didn't see any differences between males and females. But it's a question that has been brought up not only for bats, but for the other mammals that glow as well.
And is there a particular color to this glow?
Yes. So the range of wavelengths that we recorded are bright green. You can see that visually as well.
But you have also mentioned that you have a colleague, and there are others out there, of course, who is colorblind. So you're careful about talking about or describing the color.
Exactly. Yeah. A lot of studies are qualitative, which means that they do describe the color, and maybe they provide some photos, and that's super helpful. But it's really hard to make predictions and comparisons and test specific hypotheses just based on that alone, because perception is subjective. Mm-hmm. So we really aim to find a way to document the exact wavelengths, and that could be comparable.
You may have seen there's a researcher, Linda Reinhold, who spoke to the New York Times. Linda's from James Cook University in Australia, and she thinks the glow might be attributed or exaggerated because of a chemical reaction that occurs when the animals are preserved. Is that something you've taken into account?
With the specimens that we use, we don't expect that that's the case. They're just study skins, so sometimes chemicals like borax are used, and borax does photoluminesce as well. We don't think that's the case for the specimens that we use, but when you're working with specimens, that's always something to consider.
You did the bulk of this research when you were an undergrad. Even if one doesn't love bats, perhaps like the person speaking to you, the idea that they're glowing did fascinate me. What got you interested in luminescent creatures?
Yeah, I didn't know about it until I learned about it about halfway through my undergrad career. I did my research under Dr. Stephen Casperi, and he had a previous PhD student who observed some glow in another mammal, the pocket gopher. So I was super intrigued by that, and I actually recorded data for over 20 species of mammals, but really wanted to do an in-depth analysis on just the bats.
You're a master's student now. Glowing bats, more of them in your future, more research?
I do still work with light spectra, just in a little bit of a different way. I use the reflectance of different colors and the EM spectrum that plants give off from drone images to map vegetation in glacial forefields.
Do you dress up for Halloween? Are you going as a glowing bat?
I wish I had. The master students here, we actually decided to all be farm animals, so I'm currently a chicken, but it is something on the radar for next year, for sure.
Not a going chicken, just a chicken. Thank you very much for this, Brianna.
Thank you for this opportunity. Happy to talk about it.
Brianna Robertson is a master's student at James Madison University and the lead author of a paper on glowing bats published in the journal Ecology and Evolution. We reached her in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Dream weddings come in all shapes and forms, and for some people the dream is to wed as though it's the third age in Hobbiton, Middle-earth, standing there, gazing into each other's eyes, with the stirring music of the Shire playing, and Frodo Baggins himself watching with glistening eyes. Now, strictly speaking, Hobbiton isn't real. J.R.R. Tolkien made it up, and Peter Jackson made movies about that made-up place. But that was no obstacle for Sharrick and Jessica Burgess Stride. They got married in Hobbiton anyway. The movie set of Hobbiton in Matamata, New Zealand, that is. And Frodo himself didn't come due to his fictionalness. But Elijah Wood, who played Frodo in the Oscar-winning Lord of the Rings trilogy, did. And people were naturally delighted.
Congratulations.
Oh, my God!
Oh, my God!
I don't want to take attention away from you.
Our sound of the day, actor Elijah Wood, presumably crashing a wedding at the Hobbiton movie set in Matamata, New Zealand. And now here's Land of Talk with Series of Small Flames. Talk with a series of small flames.
We are going to take a short break now. When we return,
we've got a story about... I'm sorry, Neil, I spaced. Sorry.
We're going to speak with a scientist who explains what happened to Chris just now when he zoned out. We're talking about the fluid in his brain. Stay tuned. I'm Neil Kirksall.
I don't want to hear about that. I'm Chris Howden.
6:35.
It is 6:35, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your volunteer host, Ken McBride. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. We receive support from ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. And we receive support from Bridget's Pub, located in downtown Bemidji, serving Irish and American food, offering Monday night trivia at 6:30 and open mic night on Thursday starting at 6:30. More on Facebook. The Iron Range Area Council of the Minnesota Chippewa Tribes meets Thursday, November 6th at Marble City Hall. A potluck feast begins at 6 p.m. with a meeting to follow at 6:30. Meetings are the first Thursday of every month. All are welcome. Now we'll take you back to As It Happens.
It's been nearly a week now since the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces took control over the city of El Fasher, Sudan, ending an 18-month siege and triggering what aid workers and the UN are describing as a wave of mass killings. Satellite images appear to show bodies in the streets. Tens of thousands of civilians are fleeing to Tooele for shelter. And with communication lines down and roads cut off, families outside Sudan are struggling to reach their loved ones, desperate for any sign that they're alive. Nadia Taha is one of them. We reached her earlier today in Washington, D.C. And a warning, this interview contains some disturbing details.
Nadia, when was the last time you heard from your family members?
I was speaking, I think, 26, the day before they managed to take the army headquarters. I talked to my uncle, and he said that the situation is really difficult, and he managed to get to one of the neighbors' house. They have a basement, and he said, I'm not able to leave right now, and the rest of the family there on the other side, and he told me, Nadia, your house is being burned. After that, I didn't hear anything about from my uncle, and I've been calling the Red Cross, I've been calling the volunteers. I know them in El Fasher, and they haven't seen him. Until today, they sent me an image of him walking with a group of people. I recognize that is my uncle. One of the group who are trying to flee to Tooele.
So this is a screenshot from a video
online. Yes.
Who sent you that?
Photos. One of the volunteers I know, mm-hmm. She sent it to me, and she said, we saw him wearing the same jacket as your uncle. Yes.
What was it like to watch that?
It's really heartbreaking, and a lot of people who I know, actually, I've seen people who are really well known in El Fasher City, they killed in a camera, and I know some of them. I don't know how to explain it. It's like, it's heartbreaking what happened to El Fasher.
How old is your uncle? What more can you tell us about him?
He's in his 60s, but he was sick with TB, and he was in the hospital to finish his medication. The doctor told him, you have 6 months to finish all the TB medication. That's the reason why he stayed behind.
And Tooele, as you mentioned, many people trying to flee to,
yes,
to Tooele. What would that offer them if they are able to get there?
Tooele is, if you survive, if in the way, this is where like a lot of atrocities happening, the way to Tooele. Mm-hmm. That's where Janjaweed is. If there is youth or anyone, you know, they recognize them from the, you know, tribe of Zagawa, or they know them, they will kill them, definitely. You walk for 2 days to reach to Tooele. I don't know my uncle if he could manage to walk all the 2 days. He might take him more than that. Mm-hmm. If he reached there safely.
Any one of these things are certainly not small to experience, just being worried about a family member, but you're also watching these videos, as you've said, people dying. How are you doing?
Yeah. 48 hours or more, I don't know. I have not closed my eyes. It's really sad. Like, I cannot. This never in my life that I'm not experiencing that. I cannot sleep. Every time I sleep, I feel like maybe they want to tell me some news. Maybe they want to tell me something about my uncle. I have an auntie who passed away and left 7 kids. She was died 4 days before my brother. And her kids also in El Fasher. We don't know where are them. The oldest one is 10 years old. We don't know where are they. Are they safe? Are they died? Did they kill them? So believe me, every time you guys ask me question, I keep remembering. More new people. I keep remembering my family, my neighbors. It's just so crazy.
Anadia. And you mentioned your brother.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about Muhammad. What happened?
Muhammad, he was one of the Sudanese armies. He's been in the army over 20 years. Seven of his friends from the army members, they were died in a drone bomb. They killed them by drone. As soon as they left their car, they just had a drone kill all of them in one place.
I'm so sorry for your loss, Nadia, for your family's loss.
And he left his son, Ammar, and his wife, Khadija, behind.
How old is his son?
He's 9 years old.
Are they safe?
Yes, right now they're in a safe place, yes.
You mentioned, you know, other members of the Sudanese community, all of the connections, and how many people are experiencing what you're experiencing. What are they telling you?
Right now, in Washington here, a lot, we don't have a big community from Al-Fashir. We are about 6-7 houses. Every weekend, I never spend a weekend in my place. I will just go for condolence. Mm-hmm. Someone lost a brother. Someone lost a cousin. This cousin of mine, last Saturday, I was in her place because her brother passed away. Now I came back. Her sister passed away yesterday. Her name is Arafa, and she was in Al-Fashir until 26. The same day, they killed her husband, who was paralyzed. The Janjaweed, they came, they want to take the daughter, and he put his daughter under the bed, and he sat on the bed, they shoot him, and they kill him. So Arafa, she managed to take her baby, and they flee Al-Fashir on the 27th. They were on the way to Dabba, but she passed away 1 hour before Dabba. She was just maybe tired, or she had a heart attack, because she was having a diabetes for so long, and she never took her medication. And, you know, she has to run and leave the house, and she wasn't able even to bury her husband. All these things is really sad to us in Al-Fashir. This is the city where we welcome all the IDPs around Sudan. I born in Al-Fashir. Until 2003, we never had a hotel in Al-Fashir. We just welcome people. Every single house has a guest house for free. People from Nigeria, from Ghana, every people by history, they know, they pass by Al-Fashir to go Al-Hajj. They eat, they stay for free, and then they keep continue traveling. Now, this is the city where everyone is dying and they are killing because they are black. This is the war between militia and the army, but civilian, they had nothing with it. Like, why they kill civilians?
And I know you probably heard this. The RSF claims it's not targeting civilians, and that it's says it's investigating reports of abuses by its fighters.
So for someone from Al-Fashir, someone who saw how they killing people and they bury them, they didn't kill like one person or two person, thousand of them. And some of the armies, I've seen some photos that someone will go and take a selfie with the people who died. Do you think that they are not committing atrocities? They cannot tell to someone, me from Darfur, who experienced 2003, a genocide. So I know what happening and what they are doing in Al-Fashir is they don't want people in Al-Fashir. This is ethnic cleansing. They want the land. They want the gold.
We're reaching you just before you travel to New York. You have plans there to be outside the United Nations.
Yes.
Why are you going to New York?
Being a reporter, and I was doing this job for so long, but this is happening in my house, in my family place. Instead of sitting down and crying and not sleeping, I saw the Sudanese women organizing a protest in front of the United Nations where the whole world, they can hear what happened to Al-Fashir. I will go there, take pictures, take videos, but I will do anything in my hand to just help Sudanese people that they want, they remain to stay alive.
Nadia, I'm so sorry for what your family is going through. I hope you get answers soon. Thank you for this.
Thank you. Thank you.
Nadia Taha can't reach her family in Al-Fashir, Sudan. She is in Washington, D.C. his life, he's been known as His Royal Highness Prince Andrew. Now he's just Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. Yesterday, Buckingham Palace announced that King Charles will strip his younger brother of his titles. Andrew will also be forced to leave his formal residence, Royal Lodge. To the former prince, these are major losses. But to the loved ones of the late Virginia Giuffre, they're victories. Ms. Giuffre had accused Andrew Mountbatten Windsor of sexual abuse, and the recent publication of her posthumous memoir intensified public scrutiny of his connections to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Here are Virginia Giuffre's brother and sister-in-law, Sky and Amanda Roberts, on whether they believe losing his titles is punishment enough and whether Ms. Giuffre would be celebrating.
I think the king is setting a precedent for the rest of the world leaders out there to actually come forward and say, you know what, even if it is my brother, I'm going to hold him to account because I believe survivors. I saw it in the statement earlier today of, you know, survivors are front of mind, and we have to continue to keep that front of mind. But it's not enough. It's not enough. We have to have some sort of investigation that goes further into this. I mean, he's still walking around a free man. I commend the king. I think he's doing an amazing job as a world leader, setting a precedent. But we need to take it one more step further. He needs to be behind bars, period. I would say she'd be so proud. He's just Andrew. He's no longer a prince, and she is celebrating from the heavens right now, saying, I did it. This normal girl from a normal family has taken down a prince. We are so proud of her. Her survivors are proud of her. Her sisters. This is a moment that is unprecedented in history.
I remember last night before I went to bed, I looked at her photo and I had said, Virginia, we need a win. Everything that you've done, tell us that we're doing the right thing. And this happened today. And so I just know that, like, she would be so proud. And she would look at her children and say, yeah, I take down the bad guys.
She was extraordinary. She did the extraordinary. And she was goofy and fun and exciting. And you, if you got to know her on a personal level, oh, God, it's such a privilege. So I'm so proud of her. We're so proud of her.
That was Sky Roberts, Virginia Giuffre's brother, and Amanda Roberts, her sister-in-law, speaking to the BBC yesterday. Our next story is about a newly published study, and what were we talking about? I assume I'm on the radio because of this, whatchamacallit here, this thingamabob, the microphone. You know, actually, it is a good thing that I just zoned out for a minute, because science has just learned something fascinating about the process of zoning out, and it involves a fluid moving in the brain. Researchers at MIT published a paper on this in the journal Nature Neuroscience this week. Laura Lewis is the senior author. She's a professor of neuroscience and engineering at MIT. We reached her in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Professor, on which occasions do you find yourself zoning out?
Well, I wish it didn't happen, but of course it can often happen that if you're trying really hard to concentrate for a long time and you use up a lot of your energy, or maybe have had a bad night of sleep the night before, that's where I might find that one of these zone out moments creeps into my day, even when I'm trying to focus.
And what about your students? I mean, do you see it happening before your eyes in the lecture hall, or...
Yes, yeah. Sadly, you know, I try my best to be entertaining during lecture, but it has happened that I've looked out in the audience and seen someone's head just dip just a little bit, and I can tell that that's a time for me to increase the level of enthusiasm.
Maybe it's not your fault. I mean, that's research. But that's
Maybe they just really didn't sleep enough the night before.
Let's define though properly what zoning out means to you. You know, this came up in our morning pitch meeting, and you know, there are times where our mind wanders to something we're going to pitch and we don't hear something. So what do you define zoning out?
Yeah, what I define it as here and what I think is a really important thing for us to study is the moments that we have where something happens in the world that we're supposed to notice and respond to, but we just fail to detect it and fail to react. So basically, when we reach a state where, you know, something maybe important is happening, but we've dropped out of our connection to the world enough that we can't quite respond to whatever that is.
And there are serious moments as well. You know, we were laughing and zoning out during a lecture or when someone really wants you to pay attention is one thing, but there's other times where it can be a concern.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if somebody just, you know, is in a place where they could go take a nap, maybe this is not a problem. But if, for example, somebody's driving a car, a moment where you zone out could actually have life-threatening consequences. And so it really suggests that, you know, the brain kind of urgently needs something that was so important to it that it took a moment to drop out of the world, even though that could have these really dangerous consequences.
What was the moment you decided to study this? I mean, what was it, noticing someone zoning out, or did something happen in your life that triggered this for you?
Yeah, I think it came out of a deep interest in sleep. So when we fall asleep, our world is completely transformed, right? You might become completely unconscious. You might perceive things that aren't really there when you're dreaming. And then I realized that although this seems like such an almost magical thing that happens to us during sleep, that kind of thing can creep into our daily lives as well when we have these moments where we drop out. And it's almost maybe like we are a little bit asleep, even though we're awake, our eyes are open, and we're kind of trying our best to make our way through the world. So that's why how I kind of came to this question is understanding, okay, if you don't sleep, you know, you really pay this penalty the next day. Yeah. What is that coming from? What's the thing that sleep was doing for us that we so urgently need to catch up on the next day?
And this is different than looking out the window and daydreaming when you should be paying attention to something, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very different from that. So, you know, you often might not be paying attention to something, but that's because your mind is very active thinking about something else. Maybe that thing is actually more important to you and a better thing to focus on. And what we mean here is not that. We mean these moments where you're kind of trying to focus and trying to pay attention, but sort of drift away for a moment.
I liked in the research, there's a couple of ways you describe this. And one of them is that, you know, when you sleep, your brain is sort of housekeeping in there. And when you don't get enough sleep, mm-hmm. it has to find ways to get that cleaning done.
Yeah, exactly. So we know that, you know, sleep is really important for maintaining the health of the brain. And one thing that happens in people who don't sleep for a full night, for example, is that the brain starts to accumulate metabolic waste products. So you can imagine the cells in your brain when you're awake are active and they're kind of generating waste that ultimately needs to be cleaned up. And we already knew that if people stay awake too long, that there's more of that accumulation and this waste is kind of bunching up in the brain. So one of the important roles of sleep, we think, is partly to avoid that waste building up in the brain.
And what is exactly happening, you know, in those moments of zoning out, and how quickly?
Yeah. So what we found is we put people in an MRI scanner so we could take images of their brains while they were having these moments. And we measured both blood changes in their brain and also changes in a fluid that's called cerebrospinal fluid. And this fluid you can actually think of as the bath of the brain. It's kind of this watery liquid that surrounds our brain and circulates all the time and is important for kind of moving things around and keeping the brain healthy. And what we found is that at the exact moment when somebody has a sort of zone out and fails to detect this thing they were supposed to respond to in their environment, that's the moment where the brain starts to begin a kind of rush of fluid flow. So it almost seems like the brain kind of takes turns. It can either pay attention to the world or it can take a pause. And at that pause moment is when the fluid starts to kind of wash out of the brain. When the person's attention recovers, then this fluid kind of gets drawn back up into the head.
It was a small sample size, 26 volunteers for your research. Do you see that as a limitation to this research?
Yeah, I think that maybe the the more significant limitation of the population is not so much the size, but rather who it was. Mm-hmm. So these were actually all healthy, relatively young adults, and they didn't have any kind of sleep problem themselves. So I think it's really interesting in this group to discover, like, this is how the brain regulates these zone out moments after sleep deprivation. But what we don't know is, for example, if somebody's not 25, but rather 75, or for example, maybe if they have sleep apnea, how that might potentially change this. And so in the future, we would love to study a range of ages and also different sleep disorders to understand how it affects the sort of zoning out and cognitive function during the daytime.
So that you hope to do. But in the meantime, for our listeners, what do you want them, you know, what do you want anyone who looks at this research to take away from it?
Yeah, well, maybe a couple things. I mean, just on the scientific side, I think it's really fascinating now when I have those moments to have this introspective knowledge of, oh, that's what was just happening.
A little
this wave of fluid was moving
crew,
in
yeah.
my... Yeah, yeah. So that's kind of just, I think, a really cool science fact to have learned. Yeah. And then maybe more on the societal scale, I think remembering that, you know, sleep isn't like sort of just a chore we need to make time for, but it's really beneficial to the health of our brains. And so these moments that we have where we zone out might actually be a sign to us that maybe it's time, for example, to go take a nap, because the brain really does need that break from time to time.
Your teachers or your superiors at work may not want you to do that. That's the tricky part.
Well, yeah, balance. Yeah, no, balance in everything, of course. And so, yeah, and that's not to say it's always easy to take a break. People have a lot to do in their lives. So,
Professor, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Laura Lewis is the senior author of a new study on zoning out, published in the journal Nature Neuroscience. She's in Cambridge, Massachusetts. One of the beautiful things about this show is that we hear from people all over the world just by calling them up on the phone. In any given 90-minute episode, you might hear Neil speak with guests in bustling places like Singapore, London, Lagos, or Toronto. But next week on As It Happens, you're going to hear something a little bit different.
We also love taking you to smaller places where big things are happening. Those stories, though, are becoming harder to find, partly because of something else we've covered a lot on this show, the demise of small-town newsrooms.
That has left huge parts of Canada and the world without easy access to the kind of local news that we, and they, and you, used to rely on. So starting on Monday, we'll be bringing you what we're calling, As It Happens, the Hometown Edition.
They are all fascinating places, going through things that you might be able to relate to in your corner of the country, too.
That's starting on Monday and running all week. And if it happens to get you thinking about a story in your hometown that should be on our radar, we'd love to hear from you. Call TalkBack at 416-205-5687 or email us at aih@cbc.ca.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.